Welcome back to Match Volume. We're your hosts, Emma Dessau and Aib Alvarenga.
This week, we have an interview between one of our incredible team members, Sarah Brengman, and her parents, Dr. Jane Cecil and Dr. Matt Brengman.
Dr. Cecil has a focus in infectious diseases, and specifically, she is an HIV specialist.
There is so much information about COVID right now, and it's really nice to hear from two people who can break it down for everyday people like us.
And with that being said, let's dive right into the interview.
Tell us a little bit about yourself, who you are, and what you do.
My name is Jane Cecil, and I'm an infectious diseases physician.
And I'm Matt Brengman. I'm a general and bariatric surgeon and a hospital administrator.
So what is COVID-19? And just to clarify for the listeners, is there a difference between coronavirus, COVID-19, and the other names you hear on the news?
Sure. So COVID-19 is an abbreviation that the WHO came up with in February. It stands for Coronavirus Disease 2019, so COVID-19 for short. And it's the name of the disease or the syndrome, the symptoms that people with the infection get, and the infection being caused by SARS-CoV-2 or SARS coronavirus 2, which is a cousin of SARS-CoV, which is the cause of severe acute respiratory syndrome.
So the next question, and we'll keep it with Dr. Cecil, since is corona new and how is it related to past outbreaks? Like, how is it different?
So there's lots of coronaviruses. It's kind of in that same family of viruses. And they cause, not all of them are human pathogens. Some of them only cause disease in animals. I think there's four more benign coronaviruses that we've known about for a long, long time that cause more just typical cold symptoms. The three really famous coronaviruses are the one I mentioned earlier that causes severe acute respiratory syndrome, or SARS, that was described in 2002. And then after that, there was MERS, or the Middle East Respiratory Syndrome. And then, of course, the current SARS-CoV-2, the cause of COVID-19. And the first SARS epidemic in 2002 was associated with clusters of cases. It started in southern China in the Guangdong province of China, which is a different region of China from the current epidemic. And it caused a cluster of diseases. The most famous ones, I think, were in Hong Kong and in Toronto, Canada. And there was a high mortality rate associated with those infections as well. But it didn't really spread much beyond that. And really, the epidemic kind of ended in 2003. And in fact, there's only been a tiny number of cases since that time, most of which were related to laboratory accidents. The current pandemic, you know, obviously this virus seems to be much more transmissible between people, as we've seen it spread around the globe in a very short amount of time.
So we've been in self-isolation for a while, and the news about COVID-19 has been around for a while. I remember first hearing about it in January or early February after I got back from winter break and was back at school. So when did you realize that COVID-19 was going to be an issue for the United States?
I think most medical providers realized in February this is going to be very disruptive. The pace at which the disease advanced and the methods by which the Chinese used to control the disease and the impact on their economy and their way of life were so dramatic that it was hard to imagine that if cases occurred outside of China, that we wouldn't be affected. And I think you see that the large health systems in the country really took this problem very seriously and understood much sooner than maybe governmental agencies publicly reported the impact to be. And so I think I would say February, we knew this was going to be disruptive. I think the anticipation was going to be far more disruptive than it has been, to be perfectly honest. But that's a credit to sort of the interventions that we've all lived through.
I think that may be true in Virginia. I'm not sure that's true in other parts of the country.
You think that Virginia has less disruption or more disruption?
I think we had less disruption, mostly because we had more time to plan. You know, the disease spread much more rapidly in areas with bigger metropolitan areas, like New York, and sort of Washington State and California. And we've seen that in Northern Virginia, too, where the majority of the cases are in our state. So we saw this coming. We had more time to prepare. So people were social distancing here when people were starting to do that across the country. And that actually bought us a lot of time because we haven't seen the number of cases or the strain on our hospital systems, on our healthcare systems that other places obviously have experienced.
So the distinction that Dr. Cecil makes is really important. We haven't seen our medical system, and in fact, the vast majority of the United States hasn't seen their medical system even get into contingency mode, to be perfectly honest. And while we've seen a couple of areas in the country reach near crisis mode, nobody really has reached crisis mode. And so, but the economic disruption and disruption in medical care in general has been near universal. Whether you look at California or Virginia or other places, we see patients not seeking or getting routine care. And the daily machinery of medicine really come to a grinding halt. And so that's what I mean by disruption. I mean, just sort of kind of how we're living our lives, how our economic activity is going on, and then from a medical standpoint, how we're delivering our care. And some of that's going to be good, but a lot of it's going to be, is an unknown right now.
Do you feel that the media has covered the minority of the situation where the healthcare has reached its contingency point, if that's quoting you correctly?
The media has covered the more dramatic stories, whether it's the most severely ill in lower incidence areas or the most intense, quote, hotspots in the country. That's what we've seen in the media. And, you know, there's some benefit to that because the kinds of disruptions in daily activity that we think are required to control the downstream effect of the virus requires a certain level of understanding of how bad it can be. And if you're not living in the Northeast tri-state area, you're not probably feeling that too much. So the media plays a role in that and helps us understand that better. Some would say that they're crying wolf or overplaying the severity of disease, but it could be worse. And I think you look at modeling and interventions, and I think everybody in public health and in medicine really understands it could could be and could have been up until now much more severe than it is today.
I think most of the mainstream media, actually, I agree with Dr. Bregman, most of the mainstream media actually has done a very good job of kind of messaging important public health interventions, reinforcing those, including social distancing, and it has been very effective and very helpful. It, of course, depends where people get their information, but for those that tune into the national kind of mainstream media, I think it's been great messaging. There's a few exceptions to that, though, and I think the news outlets that kind of play up these conspiracy theories and downplay the importance of social distancing are actually doing a real disservice to our country and are extremely irresponsible. So those, I think, though, are the minority. I just hope the people that watch selectively those media outlets will pay attention to at least some of what the CDC and some of the government organizations are saying. I worry about that, though. Yeah.
That kind of opens us up to the next question, is how do you feel the U.S. has prepared for the pandemic, and how have your hospitals prepared for the pandemic?
I'd like to speak a little bit to how we as a nation were ill-prepared for this. I think we have some incredible scientists and public health experts, but over quite a few years now, we've seen sequential cuts to our public health infrastructure. You know, the local public health departments, all the way to the state public health departments. And you can see this even before COVID in soaring rates of other communicable diseases like syphilis, gonorrhea, chlamydia, and even HIV. The number of new HIV cases in this country has been stagnant for a decade. And there's a lot, we have the tools, we know how to manage those diseases, and it requires testing, treatment, contact tracing. Like, this is actually all bread and butter stuff for those of us in the field. We've known this for years and years and years, but the resources and leadership have been absent for a while, I think in part because at least at the federal level, there's been other priorities, and that part of our infrastructure has been neglected or cut over the years. And I think we're seeing some of the consequences of that now.
I think I can speak to preparedness for this event. And I think that there hasn't been central leadership. That has all kinds of downstream effects around resource allocation, utilization, et cetera. But as we've had in medicine over the past 10 years, a dramatic consolidation from independent hospitals and independent providers to large groups and large systems. For this particular event, we did see the large systems leverage their big data and their modeling and their resource allocation in a way that we definitely would not have seen 20 years ago. The big multi-state systems have been able to move resources like ventilators and physicians and other caregivers to locations where they're most required. And they've been able to leverage their purchasing power and warehousing to deliver things like PPE to where it's needed most. And interestingly, when it was clear that we were going to have a national shortage of personal protective equipment, or PPE, we saw incredible innovation in these systems around reuse, extended use, and reprocessing that I doubt the government could have achieved. in the amount of time that these entities were able to do it. So, you know, it's good and bad. In a crisis, you'd like to have a strong leader coordinating a response. But in lieu of that, we saw our system respond in a way that maybe it wasn't expected.
When you speak about big systems, are you talking about private health systems or private hospitals?
Non-governmental health systems. So whether they're private for-profit or not-for-profit systems, it doesn't really matter. It's the size. And when you have size, you get to leverage data and resourcing and geography to be able to do the redistribution and the kinds of things I'm talking about. So private corporations can do it, but it would be nice to have a strong leadership to set the priorities.
Do either of you have a country or model of preparedness that you really respect or feel has done a really good job?
Well, I think a great example is Germany. And I think New Zealand's another great example where they took very, very strong steps early on, have a very effective national healthcare system that all of their citizens are a part of. They did a lot early on to reinforce social distancing and to test and do contact tracing to really kind of shut down transmission. And as a result, they've had, you know, at least in Germany, the lowest number of cases and deaths. It's very impressive. And they will also probably be slower to ease on those restrictions because they've seen how effective they've been at limiting spread and reducing the number of deaths in their country.
Yeah. And New Zealand was really interesting because I think they started social distancing when they had less than a dozen cases in the nation.
Well, we know it was spreading in this country, you know, in January. And, you know, in hindsight, I think we'll realize how much earlier it arrived here than we realized and how far it had spread before we even recognized what was happening. Because we didn't have testing, really. We weren't able to do surveillance at the beginning. We still really can't because testing is so limited.
Well, moving on to the next kind of topic. Jobs have been a big topic throughout this whole crisis, but even within the healthcare system and sector, there have been talks about roles changing and hours being cut. Have your roles changed throughout the pandemic in a significant way?
The short answer is yes, and I'll let Dr. Brayman talk about that because I think he's experienced some of the biggest shifts.
So we've seen in general, hospitals reacted by trying to create bed resources and PPE resources and equipment resources by stopping the routine business of medicine in our country. And our country is quite different than others in that we do a lot of elective care, a lot of scheduled care. Care of medical necessity for the betterment of the patient to improve quality of life, but things that if they don't happen in May, they could happen in June. And it turns out that's a really big part of what we do in this country. If you look in the state of Virginia today, and it's April 22nd, and we're 4 days off of our projected peak, and we haven't done elective surgery in our state since March 15th. The census in most hospitals is running between 30 and 40% of normal, which means we have a vacancy rate of about 60%. And that's a lot of empty beds. And because, and that's a lot of work not being done. And my personal work, I'm doing less than 10% of the job that I used to do. Now, I have a secondary role in administration, and so that's occupied more of my time. But for the majority of people delivering that care, and I'm thinking of specialties like orthopedics, cardiology, general surgery. Most of those people are underemployed. Gastroenterology are, at this point, are doing far less than they used to do. And they don't have other roles to really engage in, because we haven't seen the, in our area and in most areas of the country, we haven't seen the overwhelming numbers of patients to occupy those beds. Thank goodness we don't have those patients in the hospital, to be perfectly honest. Nobody wants that kind of illness in their community. But it is quite disruptive even for the medical community. Now, are we any worse than most of the people around us? And certainly the hospitality industry has been much more affected than we have. And so we have to temper our first world problems, but it is, you know, quite a change for most people in medicine.
Let's talk about PPE or personal protective equipment.
But before we do that, can we give a shout out to some other healthcare workers and their role changes and how they've stepped up in amazing ways?
For sure.
So like at my facility, we have a dental clinic, and there's no more dental visits right now, as you might imagine, during social distancing. So our chief of dentistry at my facility now, and this is a good segue, she oversees all of our PPE distribution for our entire hospital. And she's amazing. She's former military, super detail-oriented, and she's just done an incredible job. And we have, you know, primary care doctors who aren't seeing routine clinic visits anymore coming in on weekends to call patients who have been tested in our drive-through clinic just to check on them and see how they're doing. All of those patients who get tested get daily phone calls to check on them. And our primary care docs have been doing the bulk of that, and they've just been amazing. So lots of people stepping up in lots of ways, and I want to give them a shout out for embracing their new roles.
Everybody that all of the NHS workers around the world, and then all the healthcare workers in the US, definitely deserve all of the applause and praise that they've been getting. And then it's all the other essential workers as well.
100%.
Yeah, you can't, from my perspective, undervalue or overvalue. You can't overvalue the quote frontline workers. Those are your nurses, your patient care techs, respiratory therapists, who are in the rooms with our critically ill COVID-19 patients for hours at a time on a daily basis. And as much as it is an inconvenience for any person to wear a mask around, when we wear a mask in public, we're protecting the world from ourselves. When those people are wearing a mask in the room, they're protecting themselves from a potentially life-threatening disease. And so, and there's not many people who experience that level of risk in their job every day. And so I think we can't possibly overvalue that.
So we'll move it back to the PPE question. What do the, as you said, they're protecting people from themselves, and it's all a move to help slow the spread. And so what do the people at home need to protect themselves? What's recommended? What's taking it too far? What do they need to use to protect themselves?
I do think the social distancing component is absolutely critical. And I know that's really hard for a lot of people, especially, you know, if you have young children that want to run out and play with the other kids in the neighborhood. But preventing spread and flattening the curve gives our healthcare system the benefit of time to prepare and to react and to make sure that we have going forward over time the personnel, the resources, testing capability, the PPE, everything that we need to manage this. It just slows the progression of the local epidemic so that we have time to manage it optimally. So I think that's really important from kind of the public health perspective. I mean, it will benefit everyone in the end if we have enough hospital beds, enough PPE, enough doctors, nurses, and other frontline providers. So we want to maintain that as long as necessary to make sure we have adequate resources going forward to manage this. On an individual level, just to stay safe, it is still important to maintain that social distancing, at least 6 feet, just because of how we think the virus is transmitted. And then also, you know, to avoid touching your face with unwashed hands, and to wash hands after you're out and come in contact with objects or people in other settings, to make sure you wash your hands before you touch yourself or your kind of personal items. That's all very important. And then I think it's also really important just to stay healthy, to avoid, you know, to make sure you get adequate rest, eat healthy, stay on a healthy schedule, avoid excessive alcohol or other drug use, things to just kind of keep your strength up so that if you are exposed, you hopefully don't have a severe infection as a result.
It's incredibly well said by Dr. Cecil. All of those things are true. While one of the goals of flattening the curve is to assure that we have adequate resources to treat each individual patient with their severity of disease when it occurs, but time is our friend. When you look at the agents that we were considering treatment of patients with just a month ago, it was a handful of things, some of which have really not panned out, and some of which have turned out to be quite effective. And that same list now is 20 items long with different types of antiretrovirals and or antivirals and convalescent serum and different immune modulators that, as we learn more about the disease, our toolbox for treating the severe disease gets larger and our road to a vaccine gets shorter. And so it plays in everybody's favor to delay cases to the future when outcomes will almost certainly be better.
After we talked about the healthcare workers and essential workers, we've seen them all in the news, and there's a lot of stories of fear and burnout from long hours and exposure and just a difference in the severity and urgency of the need for some healthcare workers at this time in certain places, like we said earlier, just if you're looking at the hot spots in the country right now. Do you have advice for people or other workers or healthcare workers to help prevent burnout?
It's hard to even speak about that when, you know, when I try to imagine what colleagues in New York and other big cities have been going through. I think one thing to keep in mind for most of the country is that this isn't going to be over in a month or two. I think we're going to be dealing with this for many months at a minimum. And so it's a marathon and not a sprint for the majority of places in the U.S. So we do need to be cognizant of the fact that we're going to have to pace ourselves, which means having smart staffing models so that there is relief and reasonable schedules for people as much as possible. And for individuals to recognize when they need a break and need to recharge, and taking the time to do that.
You really can't say it better than Dr. Cecil did. This is going to be a marathon. We will live with COVID disease in our hospitals for the foreseeable future. And so as we begin to contemplate a resumption of normal life, that has to include this risk and this treatment, and how do we allocate the appropriate resources? And honestly, how do we pay for them? Because when the disease is severe, it is ultra expensive. And in a, we live in a world currently where the single most common cause of personal bankruptcy is medical illness. And COVID is not a disease that discriminates necessarily. And so we have to understand how are we going to pay for that part of it also. We've spent a lot of money around maintaining our economy and maintaining our society, and that's dollars well spent. But the costs won't end in a month or two when we've passed our national peak and we're in sort of the maintenance phase. We really have to understand how are we going to support these people who survive, which is going to be the majority.
That kind of moves on to what progress is being made in treatment, and if you guys can speak to that.
Like Matt was starting to say earlier, you know, we were pretty excited about hydroxychloroquine and maybe even some of our other antiretrovirals like Caletra, which is lopinavir, ritonavir, and we're now seeing more data coming out that these aren't probably effective for treating COVID, and not without side effects, of course. Remdesivir is still in clinical trials. There's some preliminary data that looks promising. I think we're really excited to see how that pans out, but it's, you know, it's still a little too soon to know for sure how effective that's going to be. There's a lot of excitement about convalescent plasma, but again, we don't know yet. We don't have a lot of data. It's going to be really important to look at these other treatments like IL-6, interleukin-6 inhibitors and remdesivir and convalescent plasma as part of clinical trials where you really do have randomization and have control groups to see whether they work or not. And we don't have those answers yet. We're hopeful, but we don't have answers around that yet. Right now, the mainstay of therapy is really optimizing supportive care, and that's where our pulmonologists and critical care specialists are so important. And I do worry about shortages of some of the medications, the sedatives, and other drugs that are used in patients that have really severe disease. So that's another area where we really have to look at our resources and allocation resources carefully. But I think most healthcare professionals in the field recognize that. And again, stalling as much as we can, the rate with which this epidemic progresses gives us more time to, it kind of goes back to what we were saying before, gives us the time we need to prepare and make sure we have adequate supplies of those medications. Because I still think really good supportive care is still going to be probably the most important thing.
So we talked a little bit earlier about the media and for the most part, how the national media is doing a good job in explaining the severity of the disease and what is necessary for people at home to do. But is there some, who should the people at home listen to? Or do you think there's a specific place that people should be getting their information?
I want to dovetail into the last comments from Dr. Cecil. Now is a time for science. Everybody wants a Hail Mary pass. Everybody wants the wonder drug that's going to make this go away. But the reality is that doesn't exist right now. And it's not clear that it will exist. Right? And so we need to let the scientists do the work that they do, which is collect data, look at it, and make recommendations. And when they make recommendations, we need to believe them, because that's the scientific method. That's how America got to where it is today. So that's really important. And based on that, then you can think of the resources that are going to be important. Places like the CDC, they're going to put out scientifically based recommendations on how to handle yourself in public and the kinds of things that you should do for yourself. And some of those things won't have changed over the last 20 years. Wash your hands. That's maybe the most important resource that, and intervention that we can make. And so they exist, but we have to trust our legions of scientists and in this country that we employ and rely on for the advancements that we live with every day, our cell phones and microwave ovens and every other thing that makes this a great country to live in. This is part of that.
I think the state governors that are really following CDC guidance, you know, Dr. Fauci has been a really great leader during this time in his messaging, and Dr. Redfield at the CDC. I think those are the people we really need to, we as a society need to continue to look to for advice and guidance, and public health experts like Dr. Fauci, Dr. Redfield, who's the director of the CDC, and some of our political leaders who kind of follow their guidance closely, I think have done some great messaging. And those are the people I think we should be listening to right now.
But that's not to say that there's not room for robust political discourse on the broad spectrum of the impact of the disease, right? Mm-hmm. And the impact of our remedies for the disease.
Yeah.
For sure, you know, we should have that discourse, but that discourse should be rooted in science and in data and should encompass our values as Americans, and not just our moral values, but how we value life. And, you know, that's not encompassed by "I have a hunch" or "we have a miracle drug," because those are fantasies, right? We should have real discourse. And then we can make some decisions that maybe aren't only what the scientists think or the public health people think and only what the economists think.
Mm-hmm.
But it should be an open information-based process.
So we're at our last two questions. So is there anything that you would like to say to the people at home?
You occasionally see kind of these amazing acts of kindness and great creativity, and those are the things that really kind of give me hope.
I'd say two things. One is, if you haven't been personally affected by COVID-19, you should educate yourself about it before you begin to do your own value judgment about what is right and wrong. You should find out how it does affect people who either have it or are doing the incredible work of caring for those who do.
Mm-hmm.
So you can better understand that side of the equation. The severity of the disease when it's bad can't be overestimated. On the bright side, we have seen through trending and the emergency department a substantial decline in lots of routine medical problems, including heart attacks and strokes and other diseases that are thought to be of a modern society. And this is non-scientific, but it may be that a lifestyle where we spend more time at home, getting more sleep, eating out less, and not running from one thing to the next thing might be healthier for us. And people might think about that as they begin to turn their life back on and they prioritize the things they're going to do and not do.
So you both have connections to USC, and we, you know, Dr. Brigham's an alumni, Dr. Cecil is a USC mom. We really appreciate you guys coming on the podcast. And the one last thing is, if you have any final thoughts you would like to share, the floor is open for you to speak now.
Is this where you play Conquest?
We can. We could try to do that.
Totally.
That was Dr. Cecil and Dr. Brengman with our incredible volunteer, Sarah Brengman.
We hope that you heard some information that can serve you well wherever you are and in whatever circumstances you find yourself in right now.
This pandemic can feel overwhelming, and we are committed to providing valuable content to you through this season. So thanks for tuning in. We hope that this episode was helpful to you.
That's all for today, folks. Remember to subscribe and stay tuned for more impactful interviews.
Match Volume is a production by Annenberg Media through USC's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism. And this episode was made possible by Emma Desso, Naib Alvarenga, and Sarah Brengman, of course.
I'm Naib Alvarenga.
And I'm Emma Desso. Thanks for listening.